Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. A Rome of one's own, the forgotten women of the Roman Empire. I welcome Emma Southern, the author of an extremely witty and careful explication of what I've never read, the Roman Empire, the Roman Republic, the Roman monarchy, from the point of view of the women who lived and died in it. This book presents a completely new version of everything you've assumed about where did Julius Caesar come from, or what was the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, or why did it divide into Constantinople and allow Rome to attenuate so that there were less than 10,000 people there at one point around 1,000 years ago. Emma, congratulations and a very good evening to you. We begin in the monarchy, the kingdom, somewhere in the mid-8th century BCE, ending somewhere in the 6th century BCE. As told by the historian Livy, chiefly, there are other voices, but Livy is a major driver here. When did Livy write this, and who was the audience Livy had in mind? Good evening to you, Emma.
Good evening. Thank you so much for having me. Livy is writing a very long time after the period that he's writing about. He's writing in the 1st century CE, so he's writing in the reign of the first emperor, Augustus, and he is writing for an audience of people who are being forced to come to terms with the return to monarchy, essentially, to the having one man who is in charge of everything and who is reshaping the Roman Empire around himself. And Livy is part of a large cultural project, essentially, to write Roman history so that it leads to Augustus and so that it explains Augustus's prominence and his reign. The other big writer from that period is Virgil and his Aeneid, which tells a very similar story, and Dionysus of Halicarnassus, who is also writing at the same time. And they are all writing in the same 50-year period for the same audience of people who are having to relearn their history because it now needs to explain Augustus's rise and the new republic as they were coming to see it, which we now know as the empire.
What we would call in America, Roman exceptionalism.
Why we're
the victors. And they're writing for Augustus, whom you now and again, also known as Octavian, you now and again emphasize was very keen on how people remembered him, how he presented himself at the time and how he was remembered. So Livy means to flatter. Dionysus Halicarnassus means to flatter. They all mean to flatter the emperor.
They do all mean to flatter him. They all mean to help his project. And they all mean to, explain why Rome has got to this point where it is so incredibly powerful and where it has defeated pretty much everybody. Now that Egypt, they're written just after the defeat of Antony and Cleopatra and the absorption of Egypt into the empire. And that is really takes Roman power to an enormous extent. And so the other part of this project is to explain that Rome is the most virtuous and the most beloved by the gods of all the people who have ever lived on the earth.
So now that we've characterized what you're about to hear, remember, this has a purpose. It's not just once upon a time. Hercilia, married to Romulus, who is a real person to Livy and a real person to Augustus. Romulus founds Rome. And 4 years later, he wants the Roman success to grow, but they need women because they're just a bunch of men standing around yelling at each other. And now we introduce the Sabines. Who were they and who were the Sabine women?
So the Sabines are people who are from the area of kind of Tuscany. So they're from around other areas in Italy. They're Etruscan, and they are another peoples who exist in the same world that early Rome does. So Rome is founded as a city-state within a lot of other Etruscan city-states in Italy. And initially, Romulus tried to get women by sending out envoys and asking all of these city-states around Rome for permission to marry their daughters. But he had largely populated his city by offering sanctuary and asylum to people like enslaved people who had run away from enslavement, or criminals who were running away from prosecution in their hometown, and anybody who wanted to come would receive asylum there. And unsurprisingly, the Sabine people and others did not want to marry their daughters off to these new Romans. So he developed instead a plan to forcibly take himself some women, and he and his men put on a new religious festival. They claimed to have found a lost altar, and they put on a new religious festival in honor of this god that they had found, and invited people, prominent people from nearby towns, including the Sabines, to come and celebrate this new festival with them, which they did, and hundreds came. And in the middle of the games that they held in celebration, because religious Roman religious observation very often involved games and races and performances, they gave a signal, stood up, and took the women, the young women, the daughters of the Sabines, took them at knife point and carried them back to their houses as their wives.
Pulling their hair, yes, of course.
Yes, and in imagery, you see them when they've described this. They've got women under their arms, they've got women over their shoulders. There's very much a forcible taking of women.
Did Hersilia approve of this?
Hersilia, there are two versions of Hersilia. In one, she is a young woman who is taken. She's one of the women who is kidnapped. And in another version, she is an older woman who is the mother of one of the Sabine women who stays with her daughter. So all of the men run away and she is the one who stays. But in all versions, she is one of the women who is held captive. So she is not one who approves, but one who is forcibly held in Rome.
Remember now, Augustus believed this. Time passes and the Sabines men finally gather their courage to come back and rescue their wives and daughters. And yep. They meet in a contest below the Palatine Hill, and the battle goes on until at the final moment before everybody's going to slaughter everybody else, the women come back. And what do they want?
They come running down the hill. This is the final battle. The Sabines have actually defeated the Romans and managed to get inside the city walls, which is a big kind of humiliation for the Romans. But as they're about to start the final battle in the center of Rome, the women all come running down the hill, led by Hersilia. It's been long enough that these women have managed to conceive and sometimes have children. And Hersilia gives a long speech in which she implores both sides to put down their weapons, because they have turned this war by marrying these women, by having children with them. They have turned this war not into a war between enemy forces, but a war between families, because the women stand between the Sabine fathers and the Roman sons-in-laws. And now these women have the grandchildren of the Sabine men, and who are the children of the Roman men. And the broader point that is being made is that women hold men together, and that marriage and family are something that that hold men in concord with one another, and that they owe each other obligations to not harm one another once they have become son-in-law and father-in-law, father and son, brother-in-law, and that the women are the glue who hold men together and stop them from fighting.
Emma makes the point that the Sabines had defeated the Romans before this final battle. The reason is because a woman named Tarpeia, a young woman, opened the gates in exchange for what she thought would be gold ringlets, but it was not. The Sabines fooled her. And so what we have here is Tarpeia betraying Rome and Hercilia saving Rome by saying, by the way, you're all relatives. So if you're going to kill each other, kill us first because you'll make us widows and orphans. So the two women, Tarpeia, the betrayer, and Hercilia, the wise voice, they are the foundation for Rome, right there.
They are. And in that you also get a thing that you will find in a lot of Roman literature and a lot of Roman versions of their own history, and then a lot of Western literature, which is the bad woman who is saved by the good woman. The sins of the bad woman, in that Tarpeia opens the gate because she is enticed by luxury, which is a thing that the Romans thought was a profoundly female thing, is redeemed by the woman who puts her family first.
We need to pursue this good and bad woman story. I'm with Emma Southern. A Rome of One's Own is the book, The Forgotten Women of the Roman Empire. This is the Roman Empire from the woman's point of view as much as possible. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with the author, Emma Southern. Her new book is A Rome of One's Own, The Forgotten Women of the Roman Empire. Forgotten not in the least in this telling, because we go immediately to, we'll go quickly through the story of a couple of Etruscan kids. Some Lucamo, who is a Greek, but he marries an Etruscan young woman named Tanaquil, and they pick up stakes and go to the New Rome. And through an amazing series of coincidences, they become the king and queen of Rome. I'm going fast through their story, not only because it's fantastic, but because I want to get to Lucretia and Tullia. Because I'm looking for this dyad that sustains the Roman telling, recalling always that this pleases Augustus. So we're not getting a story here as we understand history. We're getting a story here that pleases the boss.
Yeah.
Tanaquil and, Tarquinius, he takes on the name of an Etruscan city to make himself king. Tarquinius and Tanaquil produce heirs, and those heirs become the kingship between the 8th century and the 6th century. And in the telling, it's important to come across a woman named Lucretia, because Emma assures me you can remove all the women in these stories except for Lucretia, and you're okay. But if you remove Lucretia, you've lost Rome.
Yes.
Lucretia is a good woman at home spinning wool for a toga. And her husband and his friends are out battling somewhere. And one night they're drinking and they propose to each other. What is their test?
Their test, they get into a bet or a drinking game about who has the best wife. The test is what their wives are doing when their husbands are away. And the idea is that if their wives are being good, then and are being faithful, then they're good wives. And if they're not, then they are bad wives. And they sneak back to Rome. It is Lucretia's husband and his cousins, one of whom is the son of the king. They sneak back to Rome and peep in the windows of their houses to see what their wives are up to. The king's sons, daughter, their wives are having a party, and they're drinking wine, and they are laughing and having a good time while their husbands are away. Drinking wine was considered to be much like having gold, to be a sign of profound female decadence. But when they get to Lucretia's house, they open the door and look in and see that she is sitting in the atrium as the sun is going down. And she is sitting only with members of her own household who are all women. And she is in one telling, weaving a toga for her husband and crying because she misses him so much. And that is ideologically, weaving is the opposite of drinking wine. One is decadence and the other one is pure virtue because it's hard and quite horrible. But an elite woman doing it is considered to be profoundly virtuous. And so Lucretia wins the best wife competition and everybody is very impressed by how glorious she is.
She's so virtuous that Sextus, the son of the king, returns in another night and ravishes Lucretia. And she calls her husband and her father and their good friend Brutus to confess to them that she's had her honor compromised. What do they say to her, Emma?
They say to her that, in a profoundly human way, they say, this is awful, but it's not your fault, and we will do what we can with this. They're very upset. She's very upset. She is coerced into into having sex with Sextus because he threatens to kill her and kill a man and put them in bed together and tell everybody that she was committing adultery if she doesn't. And she is very, very worried about her honor and her reputation. And so she, while her family are crying, she takes out a blade and says that she will not allow any unvirtuous woman to live, using Lucretia as an excuse, and kills herself in front of her family.
This is important as a foundation myth. Remember, Augustus is listening to this, and Augustus turns this story and the word virtue into a mandate for the Roman Empire. And Emma's telling us we will see that play itself out again and again. We need to see the other side of the coin, however. So when we come back, we're going to introduce Tullia, who is the opposite of Lucretia and will lead to the end of the Roman monarchy and the beginning of the Republic. The book is A Rome of One's Own, The Forgotten Women of the Roman Empire. Emma Southern is the author. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, visiting with Emma Southern, the author of a new book, A Rome of One's Own, The Forgotten Women of the Roman Empire, highly recommended, making the Romans as fresh as the 21st century in their ambitions and their retelling of the details. And we now introduce the other side of the coin from Lucretia, the virtuous one, who is celebrated by Augustus and his first century A.D., and passed on to the Julian-Claudian family as the paragon of how a woman should behave. Tullia is the other thing. She is the granddaughter of Tanaquil, that young woman who, with her husband, traveled from the Etruscan city of Tarquinia to Rome as the foundation of the monarchy. But now Tanaquil, Tullia, is more ambitious than her grandmother, although, you know, the acorn doesn't fall very far, etc. And she's married to the wrong man. Emma, this story is extremely believable because of Tullia's wickedness. Do we know what drives Tullia? Did the Romans hear this as just inheritance or something?
They hear this as a kind of almost to them cliched story of female ambition and how women have can go wrong in a very specific way, because Tullia has a sister who's also called Tullia, and they're both married off to their cousins. Each one is married to a man. They're basically married in basis of age. So the oldest Tullia is married to the oldest brother, and the youngest Tullia is married to the younger brother. And they turn out to have fundamentally opposed personalities. So Atulia is very, very ambitious. She very badly wants a public life where people see her as a queen and treat her as a queen. She wants to be in charge and she wants to be worshipped. And the fact that she is married to a man who doesn't want those things, he doesn't want to be king, he doesn't want to try to overthrow his own father. He just wants to live a gentle life. But on the other hand, her brother-in-law very much badly does want to be king. He wants everything that comes with being king. He wants the facies and he wants the crown and he wants a big throne. She starts an affair, therefore, with her brother-in-law, which results eventually in them both killing their own partners. So she kills her husband, her brother-in-law kills his wife, her sister, and then they sneak off and secretly get married and start a revolution, and she overthrows her own father. After murdering her sister and her brother-in-law, she overthrows her own father, and that is how she comes to the throne, and how Lucius Tarquinius becomes the king, and it is their son Sextus who assaults Lucretia.
So what we're looking at is the foundation myth told from Lucretia's point of view and Tullia's point of view, remembering that Livy is doing this. Ovid gets involved here as well in telling the story in which the ending will be the success of the Romans to extricate themselves from wickedness. And they will do that by running a revolution. Is that what they think of it? Do they think of it straight?
Yeah. So this is considered to be this first overthrowing of Servius is considered to be a coup, an illegitimate overthrowing of people who want power for the sake of power, and proof that monarchy is bad because it breeds these people. When Sextus then rapes Lucretia, this is the sign that the monarchy has become a tyranny, and that now no one is safe from the arrogance and ambition and entitlement, really, of the royal family. But he is terrible because his parents are terrible because his mother is ambitious, and she commits several or religious crimes to a certain extent, crimes of a total failure of duty and a polluting crime. She runs over her father's body. She disobeys her father in several ways. She kills him. And then she defiles his body. And that is the crime really that is committed, that is then reproduced in Sextus's assault of Lucretia, and then Lucretia's great virtue cleanses what Tullia has done and kickstarts the revolution that overthrows the monarchy, because Brutus takes her body, shows it as a violated body to the Romans, and they rise up and overthrow the kings and institute the Glorious Republic, which the Romans consider to be their greatest achievement and the most perfect form of government.
And 2,000 years later, we have the same Senate here in the U.S. and the Parliament in the United Kingdom. And what we have here is, again, telling Augustus it's okay to be the boss as long as you don't call yourself a king. And Augustus, and that, all of a sudden, Emma, I figured out what Princeps is all about. He wanted to avoid being regarded as a hand tool of Tanquil. He didn't want to have a queen. He didn't want to be somebody who was going to lead a revolt. And Livy and Ovid, they both understand that when they're writing. And Dionysius, he also understands that that must be the way we end this story.
Yes, we understand that always end this story with the restored republic. The republic is glorious. And Augustus says of himself, he wrote his own autobiography called The Res Gestae. And he says, and everybody says about him, he restored the republic and saved it from tyranny. And he has put everything back together and the republic is perfect again. And they completely allied the fact that he is essentially in all but name a king. But the glorification of the Republic, but the Republic centered around a single man. So Brutus then becomes the first consul. He then has a lot of power that he uses. And it is a Republic that is centered around a single family. But it is nonetheless a restored Republic.
Brutus was a friend of Lucretia's husband, and yes, he played a simple man most of his life until the moment he took charge of avenging Lucretia and establishing the Republic, the 100 senators, the 100 best men. We come now to the religion that sustains all this, that pulls it together, Oppia. Oppia is a Vestal Virgin. This is the 5th century BCE. Where did the Vestals come from? Is that Etruscan?
The Vestals are Etruscan. They're very, very ancient, even by the time that the Romans come around. They are something that exists in, as far as we can tell, all Etruscan cities. And we don't really know what the origin of them is, but they are focused on this incredibly ancient idea of an eternal flame, which is a representation of Vesta, who is one of the big 12 goddesses. In the Greek Olympian pantheon, which is, I think, more familiar to people, she's Hestia. And in the Roman pantheon, she is Vesta. And she is a goddess who embodies the concept of home and the concept of safety. And Vestal Virgins in Rome, they have 6 at all times, whose job it is primarily to tend that eternal flame in the center of Rome, to keep it pure, and to keep themselves pure, in order to keep that flame protecting Rome.
And then Oppia falls. And she is no longer chaste, and she must be punished. And the way they do it is especially grotesque, because it integrates the sin, the violation of Vestal, with the wall of the city. How do they kill her?
So they effectively sacrifice her to the gods, but without actually sacrificing her. It's necessary. The way they find out that a Vestal virgin has lost her virginity and stopped being a virgin is generally that something terrible will happen, and there will be signs and omens from the gods, and they need to placate the gods. So they make what is effectively a human sacrifice, but without having to get their own hands dirty, because they don't technically like human sacrifice. So they hold a funeral for her, where they parade her through the city as though she is already a body. And then they take her to a cave that has been dug out just inside the walls of Rome. And they wall her inside that hole in the ground with some milk, some bread, and an oil lamp. And they leave her in there to either suffocate or starve to death, which is a very slow and very horrible way to kill somebody.
Note here, there's no reason to believe that Oppia did anything wrong.
No, she was because chosen. The only evidence that she did anything wrong, really, is that some things start happening around Rome. They've lost some battles. There's been a revolt. Then they start getting omens around Roman territory. You get things like animals talking strange things falling from the sky, or strange sights and visions that you see, or unusual births are a very common one as well. And then they will hold an investigation to find out what has caused these and which god is upset. And what it comes down to is that very often that a Vestal Virgin has done something wrong. But they're never, we tend to read it that the Vestal Virgin has consensually done something wrong and has had sex, because they are given over to, they're consecrated to this life of being a professional priestess at between the ages of 6 and 10. So they're very young. It's not something that they choose, really. Their parents choose it for them. And so it's often assumed that this is consensual, but there's no actual evidence of that. And we're never very clear what it is that actually happened to them, or if they did anything at all. Later examples of women who are either tried or tried and found guilty are being tried for things like wearing dresses that are too nice, or telling too many jokes, which is considered to be unchaste behavior. And so there's no actual evidence that Opia ever did anything, just that enough people thought she did.
We must introduce Cicero's opinion of women when we come back. A Rome of one's own, the forgotten women of the Roman Empire. We're in the Republic right now, right at the end of the Republic. Caesar's alive when we come back, and so is Cicero, and so is a very rich woman named Clodia. Emma Southern, the forgotten women of the Roman Empire, a Rome of one's own. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with Emma Southern. Her witty and extremely helpful new book, A Rome of One's Own, The Forgotten Women of the Roman Empire. Just when you thought Rome was 2,000 years ago, here comes Claudia and Cicero. Cicero is a talker. He is a gifted man from outside of Rome. He's a climber. He is not one of the 100 families, or however the many there are now claiming to be patricians, the founders of Rome. And yet he has a golden tongue. He also has enemies, and one of them is Claudia's brother. Emma, this is the best version of Cicero I've ever encountered, because I've always seen him as a victim of the ambitions of men such as Caesar and Catiline and all of the pretenders who wanted to be the boss, the king, the leader. But his dispute with Claudia's brother, what is it based on? Why does he fall out with that family?
They are friends to begin with, but they fall out because Clodius commits a crime where he breaks into Julius Caesar's house while his wife is holding a religious festival, just as a woman. His defense when he is caught doing this is that he can't possibly have done it because he was out of the country at the time. He was not in Rome. And Cicero comes forward and says, yes, you were in Rome because I saw you on that day. And this starts a feud between the two of them. Eventually, in order to get revenge, Clodius has himself, he changes his name to Clodius, has himself adopted by a plebeian family so he can take a position that he's not really allowed to have within the government, and passes a law which is specifically aimed at Cicero, which makes it illegal to execute people without a trial, for a consul to do that, which is something that Cicero had done during his consulship to Catiline, and then has Cicero exiled under this law retroactively, and then burns his house down.
And so Claudius's sister is Claudia. These names can't run together. There were three daughters named Claudia, and we have to remind ourselves we're doing a little guessing here that we know the right Claudia. C-L-O-D-I-A. However, Cicero, to get back at Claudius, decides to take it out on Claudia. Why does he do that?
She is just a convenient... he'll take it out on Clodius whenever he can. When he's allowed back into Rome, he gets back into his job of prosecuting crimes. And he's just given the opportunity, a golden opportunity for him, which is that Claudia... it's a terrible time in Roman politics, and Clodia is involved in an assassination attempt against an Egyptian diplomat with a young man who is a friend of Cicero's called Caelius. Caelius then tries to murder Clodia, and Clodia takes him to court for attempted murder, but Caelius gets Cicero as his defense counsel, and Cicero puts together a spectacular speech known as the Proceilius, where he absolutely assassinates Clodia's character. He accuses her of everything from being a working prostitute to luring boys into her house in order to destroy their reputation, to being a murderer herself. And he says that she is accusing Kylias of trying to kill her because she tried to seduce him and he said no. And so she is trying to have him exiled in revenge. And he calls her the Palatine Medea, as someone who will burn the whole world down in order to get revenge against someone who has spurned her.
And it's a 90-minute speech, but every time he speaks to the Senate, he goes out of his way to defame her. What is she? Can she defend herself? How does she defend herself?
She can't defend herself. She, as a woman, is not allowed to speak in court. She will have a prosecution counsel, but we don't have whatever he said to defend it. But Cicero is remembered as one of the great great speakers of his time for a reason, and it's because he can put together an argument that feels very specific but is almost impossible to defend against. He makes few very specific claims but a lot of insinuations, and we do not know how she was able or if she was able to defend herself, but we know that she lost the case.
Yes, remember calling somebody Medea of the Palatine. Medea not only killed her children to get back at her husband who'd wandered off with another woman, she killed Jason as well. She might have killed all the Argonauts. I don't know. She just kept killing.
Kills his wife. Yeah, she kills his new wife, and then she kills her children, and then she rides off into the sun because she is the granddaughter of the sun.
So Medea of the Palatine is defamation in Rome of this time. But Caesar's coming, and the revolution that was from the monarchy to the republic is about to be a revolution from the republic to the empire. So we need to turn to women of the empire next. The book is A Rome of One's Own, The Forgotten Women of the Roman Empire. I'm going to miss Cicero. He's a wonderful, he's a wonderful character.
He is.
And in telling his story to Augustus, I can imagine that Augustus was pleased. We have 30 seconds. Who was the major source on Cicero? Cicero himself, or did somebody write
Cicero
it?
Himself.
Yeah, that's why we have him such heroic speeches. That explains him. Or as you say, he edits himself before he passes it on to history. Emma Southern's the author, A Rome of One's Own. I'm John Batchelor.
Moro Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Chances are, you've been to the doctor recently, and you probably handed over your insurance, your ID, and even your social security number. Your doctor is just one of many places that has your personal info. And if any of them accidentally expose your details, you could be at risk for identity theft. LifeLock monitors millions of data points a second. If you become a victim, they'll fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART, or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.